Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. You'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalog of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one Chris Shank. Chris has a background in animal training, having attended the Exotic Animal Training and Management Program at Moorpark College in California. She went on to become a dolphin trainer, all the while caring for her flock of 40 mixed species white cockatoos and breeding them for sale. While she no longer breeds birds, she continues to free fly her cockatoos and has been doing so for 40 years. Chris keeps up her training skills by working with her flock as well as her horse and donkey using primarily positive reinforcement training. She learns as much as she can about the four quadrants of training and their use and effects on our learners. She does so by attending training clinics, be they about parrots, dogs, chickens, or horses. Chris operates Cockatoo Downs in Dallas, Oregon, a parrot educational facility. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Chris Shank to the show today. She's patiently waiting by. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with us here at Animal Training Academy.
Well, it's my pleasure, Ryan. It truly is. You have a wonderful company and you offer so much good information to the training world out there that I'm honored to be a little tiny bit part of it. So, yeah, hope I can add some interest to parrot keeping people out there and maybe change some minds or not. Doesn't matter. But, yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Take some approximations towards changing minds. It might be changed in the future. I've seen your videos online. I've seen cockatoos flying around at your facilities from other friends of mine who visit you. Seen photos of you hanging out with Susan Friedman and Peggy Hogan, two great mentors and friends of mine. And I know that you, am I correct, live next door or down the road from Pamela Clark?
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
it's a very parrot-orientated street then, I would imagine.
Yeah. We're very, very fortunate to be friends and have the ability to meet here at Cockatoo Downs and share our knowledge. Especially, it's quite an honor to have Peggy and Susan here. I mean, it's like, oh, it's huge. So I truly enjoy that. And it's very informal. You know, we don't do anything highfalutin conferences or anything like that. It's just a group of people getting together and participants who want to be here. And we just sit around and talk training and actually do some training once in a while in between our talks. So we do have a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, we don't need formalness to learn, do we?
That's right.
We just need our hands, our ears, our eyes, our mouths, and some good company.
Yeah, that's it. It's very motivating.
So I feel like, anyway, with all of that being said and all of those pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, I think there's a terrible metaphor, but it's all that I've got at the moment, so I'm going to go with it, that have been put together. This episode has been a while in the making. I'm excited that we're finally doing it. So let's dive in and go backwards in time. Can you take us back to where you got started? 40 years you've been free-flying parrots. Where did you first learn about positive reinforcement training?
Right.
And can you share stories from your experience?
It was at the Exotic Animal Training and Management Program. And I was in the first class, or the first year that this was offered, this two-year program was offered. So that was when Bill Brisby was there, and there was a field that he had the school put up a trailer, and we built some pens, and that was it. And I heard about this program. I had already graduated college. I was an English major, and I was at a loss at what to do. I mean, it was ridiculous. So I read about this program, and I had to go through the interview process, you know, and there were, I think, 20 people that were chosen, 15 maybe. Anyway, I was one of them. So it was quite something. And part of the program was learning how to train using positive reinforcement. And until then, I was so naive about the science of behavior, the science of training. And again, that was 40 years ago. So there wasn't much out there. And so we learned that in school. And one of the projects was to train a rat to do a series of behaviors. We all had a rat and we all trained them. At the time, the Olympics was going on. So I trained my rat to do a series of, you know, jumping through hoops and hanging off of a high bar and, you know, all sorts of silly little things. But it was a big hit, not just me, but the other trainers as well. It was a big hit, and we were in the newspaper, and it was kind of fun. So that's where it all started as far as positive reinforcement training. Oddly enough, if I can add this, after learning that, I did not carry it over to my own animals. I mean, it was very bizarre. And I've talked to other people who have said that. And I think it's because, you know, I wasn't raised that way. We weren't raised to train our pets and companions in that method. So even though I learned it in school, I didn't transfer it over to my dog or to my horse. It's very interesting. So anyway, from the Exotic Animal Training Program, we had to do an internship. So I did an intern at Busch Gardens in Van Nuys, California, and it was a bird park. And they had all sorts of species of birds on display. And they also had a small bird show, and which featured macaws and cockatoos. And there again, even though we were positive reinforcement trainers, Busch Gardens had in the bird show a group of Galerita galeritas. So they were, you know, I assume they were wild cockatoos. And they had been trained by a company, not by Busch Gardens, not by the staff at Busch Gardens, but they were trained off-site, and they came to Busch Gardens to perform in the show. And yet it was not with positive reinforcement. We had to hold a stick, and I think about it now, and if a bird got out of line, we would kind of, you know, tap on the table there, and the bird would immediately jump back to where he was supposed to be. It was, again, a strange scenario. So positive reinforcement training was out there, but it wasn't pervasive like it is today. Then I moved on to being I don't want to say trainer, because I really didn't do any training, but I did work with dolphins at a amusement park in Santa Clara, California, Marriott's Great America, it was called at that time. And they had two dolphins, and an animal show as well. So they had they hired contractors. The dolphins were contracted. There was a little. There was an elephant that was contracted. There was a sea lion that was contracted, and they all kind of mushed together into a half hour, 40-minute show. And so I ended up getting a job working with the dolphins. And from there, I moved to the Philippines, because I was married at the time, moved to the Philippines, and my husband was going to school at vet school there, and we collected some cockatoos while we were there, and I brought them back to the U.S. for breeding purposes. And also, I worked at a dolphinarium in Germany during that span of years. And that was an interesting gig as well. And then when I finally got back to the U.S., I just concentrated on breeding cockatoos for the companion market. So that's my short, uneventful history in the training world.
Well, most definitely don't want to draw attention to timelines, but acknowledging that when you were at Moore Park College, Ryan cartilage was not a thing.
Oh, gee, Ryan. You missed so much back in the day. That's pretty funny. Yeah, well, it's changed so much, Ryan. It's just unbelievable how much this industry has changed for the better, by the way. So that's great.
And I'm so curious. You said that you learned this information, you trained a rat to do the Olympics.
Yes.
But then you didn't bring this over to your own animals. And it reminded me of stories I've heard from trainers who run classes, who teach targeted training, and then they see the dogs in the car parks just doing undesirable behaviors from a human perspective, and thinking target training, the stuff that those clients were just doing in this class would be so helpful right now, and the clients have no idea how to manage their dogs. Has that lesson kind of stuck with you? It just made me think about generalization and doing that with our animals, and how we also need for our clients to consider.
Well, what strikes me is more personal. What strikes me is, why didn't I generalize this new education to other animals? And I still don't have a concrete answer for that. And how to present that to maybe a client, if you're a dog trainer and you have a client, how to present that and say, this can influence your whole life, not just your dog. And I think, I don't know how to do that. I don't. I think Karen Pryor's Don't Shoot the Dog is a good book to read, because it shows us that she brings in the outside world and not just animals, but people, and how positive reinforcement training can influence all of this. So, I wish I had an answer for you, but I don't.
I'd rather you say that than try to make one up on the spot, which I often try and do. And so working with dolphins, I imagine there must have been some valuable learning opportunities whilst you're in Germany and working with them in the States there. Can you think of any stories that stick out from those times that still stick with you today?
Yeah. Yes. And the trainers who I worked with, it was a husband and wife team, and they were part of this contract business. The business was owned by Ralph Quinlan, and he had dolphin shows. He was located in North Carolina, and he had dolphin shows contracted out around the U.S., and he would hire staff that weren't necessarily trainers. He would, train them to be dolphin handlers or trainers, whatever you want to call it at that time. And so these two people were there, and that's who I worked under. And I remember they were trying to get a dolphin to go through to the holding tank. And it was a little tiny pool to begin with. I mean, the regular show pool and then the holding pool, they were both small. But in any case, one dolphin would go in very easily. The other dolphin wouldn't. And they tried and tried and tried. And one of the trainers got so angry that he got the one dolphin who went into the holding tank nicely, that dolphin went in and he was so angry that he took a whole big bucket of fish and he dumped it into the holding pool and yelled at the other dolphin, "You're not getting anything." I mean, that was the type of training and it stuck with me to this day. And that was an example of people who didn't know what they were doing and an employer who didn't care about the animals to educate the staff well enough in this type of training. So it wasn't pretty. It wasn't fun. I ended up leaving because it wasn't fun after a while. So there's an example.
And then, so did you find mentors in that time? Were there people?
No.
You didn't?
No, I did not. And even in Germany, I knew a little bit more about what I was doing as far as with training. And I saw the same abuse going on in Germany and to a chimpanzee. And I was not in a position to say much about it. Again, another husband and wife team when, you know, you don't have much power when you're up against that. So I left there after a year. So yeah, there, it's not a pretty sight out there in a lot of, and it probably still isn't today. So I decided to get out of training altogether.
And so you were in the Philippines, you did something that you might not be able to do today and bring a whole bunch of cockatoos back to the States.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to be very honest with you here and your listening audience that, again, I was ignorant. I was naive. I wasn't paying attention to conservation at that time in my life. And I did not understand how I was able to even buy these birds. I didn't understand that they'd been poached. I didn't understand, you know, that hundreds had died so I could have these six or whatever amount I was acquiring. And it's a very shameful part of my past. I certainly know better now. I attribute it to being immature and not paying attention to what goes on in the world of conservation. So yes, that said, yes, I did. I acquired cockatoos and I came back thinking, because at that time, cockatoos were being captured and sold to the pet trade here in the U.S. And I thought, well, I'll have a positive influence by breeding birds here and selling them hand-raised. That way they won't go out and catch them in the wild, right? So that was my thought. And I was a very, very small breeder. You know, I maybe produced maybe six birds a year. It wasn't a big deal. But yeah, so that's what I did for many, many years. And about 20 years ago, I stopped breeding and started concentrating on training, learning about training, teaching people how to live successfully with their parrot. And that has led me down a wonderful path that I'm delighted that has opened up to me and brought in all these mentors and wonderful, knowledgeable people that I can learn from.
We appreciate your bravery in sharing this with us. And I'm kind of reminded of what Margie Alonso calls her giving a shit a meter. and that you've kind of at peace with that and you're giving a shit a meter kind of allows you to bravely talk about these things whilst other people might feel a little bit vulnerable in sharing that information. How do you view that part of your life now? Like, how does that add to you as a person?
Yeah, well, I view it as a 72-year-old woman looking back at a 25-year-old woman who didn't know her what from her what, you know. You know, she did, as a very young, naive woman. And I don't blame what I did. I don't blame myself for that. It's a growing experience. I'm certainly not proud of it. And it also has made me acutely aware of what's happening today, in that poaching is still happening. And we're still fighting that. So I support World Parrot Trust a great deal, as a matter of fact, and other, the Katala Foundation that is working with conservation of the Philippine cockatoo. I support them. So that's how I am alleviating some of my guilt, maybe, or you know, just trying to help now.
And I feel it reminds me of a lot of guests who come on here and share that they all started with aversive training techniques and had that switch over later in life, and how that's helped them become maybe a more compassionate person now, and looking at others and understanding other people's journeys. So once again, thank you for sharing that. So bring us back to when you did make that switch. What happened when you decided to stop breeding, and how did your journey continue at that point?
Yeah. Well, you know, it was gradual. It wasn't an overnight thing. But I just decided that it wasn't fair to the birds. I started seeing problems that people were having with cockatoos specifically, because they can be a challenging animal to live with, and especially hand-raised ones. So I decided not to add to the population anymore, and again start focusing more on training and helping people live successfully once again with their parrot. And so I eventually moved up here to Oregon, and that's when in California, in Grass Valley, California, we started holding 1 and 2 day seminars, and people would come, and I'd have speakers come in, and we'd talk about cockatoos and training and conservation. And then I moved here to Oregon, and I kept doing the same thing, although Well, not a smaller scale, but we don't have as many people. So Barbara Heidenreich and I and Pam Clark started doing our positive parrot training retreats, and we've had 6 or 7 of them. We've stopped doing them now. 2 years ago was our last one. But we would have people come and bring their own parrot, and it would be a 4 or 5 day workshop, and people would work with their birds, and we would coach them, and then they would work with the cockatoos, and we'd coach them, and then we'd free fly the birds out, not their birds, but free fly the cockatoos outside. And so it was really a lot of fun. By the end of the 5 days, it was quite a lovely community that had been established. And hopefully people took home some lessons that they learned while they were here with their parrots.
Yeah, well, we definitely felt the ripples from that down here in New Zealand, watching videos shared on social media. So now in 2020, you're a sought-after speaker. I believe, got some things in the pipeline that I don't know if you can or can't talk about, so I'll leave it up to you to share. But for anyone that wants to learn more about what you're doing in 2020 and get in touch or find you online, is there anywhere that you can direct them?
I have a Facebook page. It's called Positive Parrot. No, it's called, excuse me, it's called Cockatoo Downs Positive Parrot Training Retreat. I didn't name that. Somebody who was at the retreat named it and started the Facebook page, so I just kept it. And I'm on there infrequently. I don't do Facebook much anymore, and I'm not on social media all that much, but they can do that. They can contact me by email, which is chris.shank@icloud.com. And so those two methods.
And are there any plans for future events at Cockatoos Down? What does the future of Cockatoos Down look like?
Yeah, well, what we started last year is we had Peggy Hogan here for one workshop. It was a two-day workshop, and that was 2 years ago. And we had a group of 10 people come, and we, Peggy is such a motivating force, and she's such a great teacher. And she was excited to work with the cockatoos. So I said, why don't we have a combination? Because we have a donkey available, we have a horse available, I have a friend who brought her two mini horses. So we have the equids available to work, and we also have the cockatoos available to work. So let's just combine that and have talks. We're in the house talking and having little mini lectures, and then we go outside and practice what we were just talking about and on the various species that are available to us. And it went exceedingly well, I thought, humbly, I say. And somehow I said to Peggy at one point, why don't we ask Susan Friedman here? And oh my gosh, we thought that was a great idea too. And we asked her, and my mind just exploded because she accepted and she came. And it was another great learning experience for us all. And that was last summer, and we were going to do it again in June, but ta-da, you know what happened next. So hopefully we will transfer that workshop to 2021, in the summer of 2021, when everybody is healthy and we've got a vaccine out there and we don't have to worry about anything, right?
and agree with comments about Peggy's motivating forceness. Forceness doesn't sound like a good word, does it? But I believe Peggy's actually the ripple responsible for this podcast and originally sent the email. I can't remember now. It's been a while. So how do people come to this event? Because you said it's just a small collection of people.
Yeah, and I will say because we don't, when the retreat would happen, we would use the barn, the bird barn, to present the speakers. Here I've scaled way back, and so it's almost like invitation only. It's sort of become that. What we like to focus on right now is are people who have a background and a knowledge, not PhD knowledge, but a knowledge of training and the four quadrants and that type of thing, because we want to kind of jump right in and not have to lay out the foundation. We want the foundation already there in people's heads. Does that make sense? So they come here and then we can expand on new ideas and new information that's maybe come down the pike. And we're kind of all on the same page. So right now it was through Pam's clients. Some of the clients would be interested. Some of Peggy's clients would be interested, that type of thing. And then we will ask them to come if they want. Yeah.
Exclusive. Like it.
Hey. Oh, yeah. Hoity-toity.
Thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Chris. We love hearing about what we call people's behavioral odysseys, so appreciate you sharing. Moving forward, when we caught up for our pre-podcast catch-up, we discussed talking about free-flying your parrots and whether you, your resources, and your birds are good candidates or not. And we discussed four considerations that you have when preparing, or that you want to offer our listeners when preparing and training a bird for free flight. So I'm keen to dive into these. Did you want to add anything to get started on this topic, or just dive straight into these four considerations?
Yeah, let's just go and see what happens.
All right. So number one was parents education.
Okay. So what we're talking about here is I free fly hand raised cockatoos, and I free fly parent raised cockatoos. So I guess what you and I were discussing was the training of the parent-raised cockatoos. And I don't know if you want to go further down that road. Is that okay? So I am switching my views on parrots as companions. I am becoming to believe, and I am promoting, that parrots should be parent raised if they are going to go into the companion home. And we won't go into that. That's a whole nother, you know, lecture, I guess. But there's more and more evidence that hand-raising parrots doesn't do them any good and doesn't do the owner, the parrot companion owner, any good either, as far as behavior problems and that type of thing. So I have three generations of parent-raised cockatoos that I have trained to free fly to support the fact that a bird does not have to be hand-raised to be a successful free flyer, because I don't know them all, but some free flight parrot trainers that I know of promote that parrots should be hand-raised to be successful free flying. So I've said, not necessarily. And eight years ago, I had a pair of little Corellas, bare-eyed cockatoos. They had two offspring, the same clutch, and they are now, 8 years later, very successful. The birds that were parent-raised 8 years ago are now stupendously trained free flight cockatoos. Those birds last year went on to raise their own chick, another little Corella, who I decided to make a project out of so that I could present this material not only in the written form, but also in speaking engagements if anybody was interested. So I had the parent-raised Corellas raise their chick. I did not handle the chick at all in the nest. I peeked in occasionally to make sure everything was okay. The birds raised the chick up to fledge. In the meantime, these parents had been trained, are trained free flyers. So I would work them in the aviary while their chick was in the nest box. And we would, you know, do targeting. I'd have them station. I'd have them fly from perch to perch. I'd have them fly to my hand. I even had them fly outside while their chick was in the nest box. So we kept that up. By the time the chick came out, she didn't want anything to do with me, of course. Oh, and by the way, I have other people work the parents. So people they know, people they don't know, because they were also used in the training retreats. So they're very used to working with other folks. And so the chick came out, didn't want much to do with me, and that's fine. I still went in there and worked with the parents. The parents are modeling, right? They're modeling to their chick that this creature is okay. You get goodies from this creature if you want to cooperate. And eventually, after whatever, you know, 2 or 3 months, whatever it is, the baby, her name's Star, she's a year old now, she is recall trained, she stations on the perch, she targets. I'm now teaching her to go into a bird crate, a carry crate. And she flies outside wonderfully well. It was a magnificent experience for me. And to watch how both the parents taught her and I taught her. And our team effort has created this lovely little being who is a cockatoo, knows she's a cockatoo, but yet wants to interact with people as well. That's what I like.
So I guess there's multiple people listening to this show who this has relevance for. Those who might be in the position such as you were with, was it Stella?
Her name's Star. That was close. Sorry. That's good. Star. No, same thing.
And have access to do what some of the things that you've just described. There are those that are potentially working with pet parrot owners who are maybe requesting their services to to work or free flight. And there might be those who are training up birds that they've purchased for their own reasons. So what do you have to say to the pet parrot consultants?
Right. I'm, first of all, here to say I am not, that's not, and that's underlined, I am not promoting free flight. It takes us, it takes knowledge of the bird, it takes knowledge of the species, it takes knowledge of your surroundings, it takes training, a high amount of training knowledge. And I just don't want to say to everyone, now I know people who listen to you have a lot more training knowledge than the average bear, right? So I wouldn't have a problem with that. It's people who go out and buy a bird specifically because they just want a bird in the house. And, oh, look at this. You can maybe even fly them outside. How cool. No, that's not what I'm promoting or the audience I'm talking to. So if you, and I think some of the trainers, the free flight trainers out there certainly will embrace those people and teach them to train their bird. Okay, fine. If that's the way they want to go, then go for it. My concern is I don't like online training of free flight. It has to be, for me personally, has to be the trainer, the coach, the mentor, has to be in person so that they can see what's going on with the bird, can understand how skilled the trainer is or unskilled the trainer is. They can actually do training outside together and, you know, that type of thing. Sort of like a, you know how falconers have to have what's it called? I don't know. They need a coach.
I don't know what the correct word is, but let's just call it a mentor for.
Okay, a mentor. and in order to get their falconry license, they have to learn from an actual human being right there in front of them. And that's the way I feel it should be with parrots. And I also have problems with people who fly their birds singly with all by itself, that's to me is very dangerous. I have a problem with people taking their birds, their bird away from home to fly in strange or unfamiliar territory. And yes, I know there's success stories out there all over the place. Me personally, I just am not comfortable doing that. There's, you know, parrots, all birds learn their territory and learn through others, learn through their flock members and things like that. And taking a bird who's not used to, who's used to maybe flying around their house area that they know very well, outside the house area very well, and then all of a sudden dumping, you know, going to a soccer field or something that they've never seen before and expecting them to fly successfully, sure, they may fly successfully, but will they be comfortable? How stressful is that for that bird? I mean, we need to think of not just how cool it is to watch our birds fly. We need to also think about their welfare. And I think that gets lost in the mix in a lot of the time.
And so do you have people reaching out to you online and saying,
no.
Just because you're not putting that content out, people are like.
Yeah, no, I'm real low, low key about my free flight. And the most attention it's gotten, I suppose, is through the training retreats because the videos get out there. If an occasional person does ask me, do you train? Would you help me train my bird? I say no. Do you know of any trainers? I say no. And I pretty much explain what I just explained to you. And either they get the message or they don't.
And has any part of your, so you've done the trainers retreats. I'm just curious to leverage this opportunity to have someone on the podcast show with 40 years of experience, and not just at training cockatoos and training animals and working with animals, but of, let's get all meta here, of life. And I feel like there is, I'm going to own it and label it, this thing called Trainer's Dilemma, where people come and they're like, hey, yo, I have this animal. Let's, you know, one that might be familiar with the podcast audience. I have an aggressive dog and I need your help with it. And I want to use this shock collar to like teach him to be known. And that dilemma where, yep, we kind of want to change people's perspective, but additionally, in my personal opinion, this is Ryan's opinion, everyone, the best thing to do there might be to listen rather than to and try to understand what this person's problems are and kind of how they in their specific unique situation could you could add the most value. And it might not be just jumping in and being like, hey, ethics and all of this kind of stuff. And I wish that the podcast audience could see our guest's face sometimes. Chris's Sorry. Face is like, what the hell are you talking about, Ryan? No, but I'm just curious about your perspective from life. I can see that you're, you know, because free flight parrots is a big controversial, is that an okay word to use? It's a controversial area of pet parrot ownership. And so for the consultants out there, and I know that you don't do this, and I know that you don't have people come to you for this reason, but I'm just curious to hear your thoughts. Like they say, hey, I want to free flight my bird. And you're like, well, my ethics say that that's probably not the best option for you right now. But I know that you're going to explore this path, whether with me or without me. Like what advice do you have to those people doing those consults? Like how can they best help these people? And more importantly, their parents?
Well, you know, if they want to listen to me and my ideas and thoughts about free flight, wonderful. Then I will explain that to them. Or I just direct them to other trainers who have the same perspective that I do. So Hillary Hanke is one who's written fantastic articles about free flight, the problems with free flight, the wonderfulness of free flight, the this, that, and the other of free flight. And it's right there in black and white. And that's from a person who knows of what she speaks and doesn't make it into this lovely fantasy of, you know, fly free, my parrot. It's nitty gritty. It's the good and the bad that goes along with this. And I think that's what we need to emphasize, is that it's all not peaches and roses out there. Your bird can get killed. My birds have gotten killed. I've lost birds in the past. Certainly I have over 40 years, you know, and, gosh, instead, can you maybe make a nice aviary that the bird could fly in, and you could play with the bird in there? You could practice, you know, recalls and things like that. So I would say, please don't get captivated by this lovely vision that a lot of these free flyer people will put out there, and trainers as well, especially with the spectacular videos that I've seen, you know, these beautiful macaws flying and, you know, in canyons and out in the fields. I mean, they are spectacular, and it can take your breath away, and it can certainly put a fog in front of a companion parrot person's eyes and say, well, gee, I could do that. Right? So, yeah.
Seeing Michael Jordan play basketball and picking up a basketball and being like, yes, I'm going to be Michael Jordan now. Here I go. And then you exactly. shoot the ball and you get an air ball and you're like, hang on, what? That wasn't supposed to happen.
Exactly. And yes, free flying is controversial. It's becoming more popular because of social media, and that scares me. There's been books on free flight training I've seen that are absolutely atrocious. So yeah, it's like anything anything new, it's going to take time to develop into something that's worthwhile and something you can have trust in. Right now, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know where that comment is leading, Ryan.
There was some great takeaways in there. I mean, you said direct potential human learners who come to you to relevant resources. We've done a podcast with Hilary Hanke and we talked about this subject. It was years ago. I think it was like 2017. Mm-hmm. So you can go listen to that and it's, her articles are linked from that podcast. She might have done some more recent ones as well, but you can find all of those on her blog. You also mentioned there, with this, it's a matter of life and death. It can be, and it quite often is. Mm-hmm. Or you don't know because you never see your bird again.
That's right. That's right.
And maybe do you think making those consequences, having a frank conversation about those is helpful for people?
Yeah, I wonder. we have a tendency to have a lot of bias going on, right? We hear what we want to hear. And I don't know, it can't hurt, but I don't know how helpful it is. I had a person who came to one of our workshops a couple of years ago. She was flying two military macaws, I believe they are. And she would take them, and she knew about training. She wasn't great about training. I mean, she had a knowledge of it, and they were hand-raised birds. And she would take them up, two or three hours away from where she lived, and she would fly them with another man who raises macaws, and he free flies all his birds. And they would meet out in a field of some type. And that's pretty much how she trained her birds. And in my mind, that's not training. You know, she would take them up there. They would fly around with this man's macaws as a flock, and then they would come back and become trained, air quotes there. And one day the birds flew off with the flock and only one of her macaws came back and was never found again. So things like that happen, and that could be prevented, and that was from poor training. I'm not blaming her at all. It's just that the knowledge is not out there. It's out there, but she didn't manage to find it. Or again, she was blinded by the success, apparent success of this man and his macaws, who, by the way, also lost one of his macaws not too long ago. So, that's just the nature of the beast as it stands right now.
And another great suggestion you made, I thought anyway, was to offer people what they can do instead, which was make a nice aviary.
Aviary, yeah.
So some great suggestions there. Now back to go full circle, back to the start. What you're suggesting in 2020, July 2020, it might be different in December 2020, who knows? But what you're suggesting in July 2020 is parent-raised birds, where you're doing training with the parent, you're doing training with the chicks. The chicks are getting social learning, they're learning natural behaviors, and you're also inviting other humans to come and interact with those birds. And that's all, in your personal opinion, am I understanding this correctly, the best, we don't use recipes, but a potentially good recipe for a large majority of individual parents to...
It would be nice. I'm smart enough to know that that's not going to happen. And I do know that the finished product, if you want to call your flyer a product, is a bird who is extremely talented and self-sufficient enough to free fly, and as well as interact with me as their companion. I don't see it as a way, how am I going to say this? I guess it just boils down to, it would take a whole new infrastructure to do that, right? Because you've got to get parents who are going to raise the birds. You know, it's a whole big deal when it's pretty darn easy now to have just go out and get a little hand-raised bird and raise them up yourself and go out and free fly. So I don't know what the answer is. Again, I don't know what the answer is. It just is my experience for now. My personal experience is I would much rather have a parent-raised cockatoo, period, whether the bird flies or not. And at the same time, I would rather have a parent-raised cockatoo, or I have shown that parent-raised cockatoos can be successful free flyers.
Right, so if you're listening to this episode, chances are your parents weren't raised by their parents. Your bird potentially wasn't raised by its parents. It might have been a hand raised bird, depending on where you got it from. And if it was raised by its parents, some of the ingredients that can lean themselves towards helping that bird be a successful candidate for free flight. Like the ones we mentioned before, working with positive reinforcement with the parents and the chicks, allowing all of those social learnings to occur, natural behaviors, getting other humans to work with that chick when it's young. Chances of your chick falling into that category might be relatively slim, which means that there are some alternative options you can offer your birds, like building a nice big aviary for it, continuing to educate yourself, understanding the risks involved with free flying, and I guess that's that, black and white. We don't know, and I like that you don't know what the answers are, but you're asking the questions. I think that's, you know, where else can we be?
Yeah, this is new territory as far as I'm concerned. I think even bringing up the idea of parent-raised parrots as companions, regardless of whether they free fly or not, is new territory. And like I said before, you know, in fact, there was... there's a veterinarian, Dr. Van Zeelen, I believe her name is. She's an avian vet, and she gave a presentation not too long ago, and she says that there's indications and possible research that shows that hand-raised birds, parrots, are more susceptible to feather destruction behavior, you know, and so that is huge to me. I mean, none of my parent-raised birds do any feather destruction. Well, actually, no, none of them do, but that doesn't mean anything, actually, in the big picture. But I'm glad that in fact, the Netherlands have outlawed hand-raising parrots. Now, I don't know how many, you know, how they enforce that. But again, it's getting back to the ethics and the welfare of these birds that I don't need to get into right now. But I'm becoming very sensitive to having parrots as companions in the first place and how we can make their lives even better than I perceive that they are now. And that is through parent raising.
We have to celebrate the approximation, I guess, that conversations are happening in the Netherlands, which have led to the current legislation they have in place. How did that come about in the Netherlands? Do you know?
No, I don't. I sure don't. And like I say, how many people follow it? I'm sure breeders had a lot to say about it. It would be, in fact, it would be very interesting to find out.
Well, I mean, I don't think people even follow legislation with regards to dog ownership.
No. Right. You're right. What are you
going to
do?
So, but I'd be interested personally to learn more about what conversations happened in the Netherlands to get the policy makers to listen and to make those considerations and curious what we can learn from what conversations are happening there. Hey, we're heading towards the ending of this episode. We're ending right now.
Okay, good.
No, but before we just wrap up with getting your thoughts about, and I think you've already said it, but we'll get you to restate it, your thoughts about what you want to see happen in the next 5 to 10 years. Do you have any final comments or offerings to make on
final conversation today? I do. I have a little list, a little tiny list, and on the whole, I absolutely see the training world, the animal training world, as headed in the right direction. My gosh, the changes that have been happening is, especially in the last decade, is like lightning speed as far as I'm concerned. And the information available and people like Susan Friedman and Dr. Joe Lang, who comes on and talks about, you know, human behavior, but yet he's done research with animals and how that's applied with Barbara Heidenreich and what she uses in her training. And it's all out there for us to absorb and get excited about. And Ryan Cartledge, who has this huge library of things to read and listen to, we have no excuse other than, you know, if we claim we don't know anything about training, we have no excuse. I'm sorry. So anyway, as far as that goes, I think that's all I need to say about that. I'd like to emphasize that parrots should be parent raised, and if you are interested in free flight, please do homework before you decide to go down that road. And yeah, that's about it.
Well, once again, thank you so much for sharing everything today, Chris. I had a lot of fun getting to know you better and hearing your perspectives. I feel like we just scratched the surface of 40 years of learning and growing. And as we mentioned, for those that want to get in touch, the best place to go is the Cockatoo Downs Facebook page. And you mentioned your email earlier, which we will include in the show notes for this episode. So let's take this opportunity to express gratitude to you. We appreciate you coming on the show today. Thank you so much.
Been absolute my pleasure, Ryan. Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to learning more from you.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. That's it for this episode though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much everyone for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.